This is the School Success Podcast, a podcast for school leaders to learn from other school leaders what's working and what's not, and to get inspiration and encouragement, as well as strategies to grow school enrollment, connect with families, retain teachers, recruit teachers, and everything in between. You guys are heroes, and I cannot thank you enough for pouring into this next generation that's coming behind us. My goal is you will take at least one thing away from every episode that you can take back to your school to make it better than it is right now. Please enjoy the School Success Podcast. Hey, school success makers, welcome to another edition of the School Success Podcast. I'm your host, Mitchell Slater. I'm joined by a new friend out of Fargo, North Dakota, Paul Fisher, who is the headmaster of Capstone Classical Academy. I got connected with him through a friend who told me about him, and we connected and got to talking. And I was like, man, this guy has to be on the podcast because they're doing some really, really cool things in North Dakota, building a beautiful state-of-the-art facility that I want to dive into to that in the podcast episode today. And we're going to dive into some fundraising questions that I have for him. Whole bunch of fun stuff you're in for today's episode. But before we dive into all that, I always like to pass it off to our guests to introduce themselves. So Paul, welcome to the podcast today, sir.
Hey, thanks, Mitchell. It's good to be on with you.
It's going to be fun, man. I always start with the same question. If I was to visit Fargo, North Dakota, because I have not. I've been to North Dakota, but I've never been to Fargo, North Dakota. What would you say, Mitchell, you got to do this to have the full Fargo experience? Is there something I need to eat or something I need to do when I'm there?
You know, this is really sad for me to tell you this, but in Fargo, especially this time of year, people still go to the mall. There are so many restaurants, I think per capita, probably near the top of the list of cities our size. I mean, the Fargo-Moorhead area is probably 250,000 people. That includes Moorhead, Minnesota, just across the river. And everybody's always eating, just always eating and shopping. And there's some arts in Fargo, but not a lot. It's a college town. People are big on the bison, and they say bison. I say bison, but I should correct myself. And so they're big on NDSU sports, UND hockey, and eating food and going to the mall, because it's a place where it's warm enough that you'll survive if you're out for 15 minutes and they just walk the mall. There's lots of places to sit by fireplaces in the mall. So it's a strange kind of 1980s throwback to be in Fargo.
Man, is there a specific food that's like their thing? Yeah, sweet tea in the South and, you know, pimento cheese and barbecue.
These are Norwegians. The churches have lutefisk suppers, which are like fish preserved in lye. It is not very appetizing, but what people do it, I think, just for bragging rights and just to stay connected to their heritage, probably. You know, it was a matter of survival to preserve fish that way. It wasn't considered tasty. It was just, and we don't have to do it anymore. So I don't know why people do it, but I think it's just a connection with their heritage. And that's about it. I mean, there's like some Norwegian foods, but they're all like survival foods. They're nothing that you actually want to eat. And so there's no delicacies, so to speak. That's just kind of how it is in the upper Midwest.
Man, you're having a hard time selling me on this Fargo, North Dakota. You gotta sell me on this, man.
Capstone's the only reason to come. I mean, it's the best thing going on in Fargo, but people always say it's the best place to raise a family. And I think it's a very livable city. The weather's tough, but the whole city is designed around family, from the park system to the bike and jogging paths that you can get anywhere all over town. And it's mostly new, which is weird for a guy coming from Philadelphia, but that, you know, most things here have been built since 1950. And so it's relatively a new city in that respect. So the infrastructure is really good. And it's just, it's not a cultural center for the country, but it's a little bit of really peaceful flyover territory. And people tend to like it. They feel a little insulated here. And they like being on this, they feel like it's kind of a cultural island where they can escape from some of the things going on in the rest of the country.
Very cool. Their own little country. It's kind of like when I grew up in Alaska, they felt very much like we're not a part of the rest of the states right over there. So I can see North Dakota doing the same. Very cool. Well, as we dive into then the school, tell me about a little bit about the background of Capstone. We'll dive into the main questions I have just in a little bit, but let's hear about just Capstone, maybe how long they've been around, how they got started, just a quick little thing on that.
Well, you know, from talking to school leaders and being aware of what's going on in the non-public schools across the country, there's been an expansion since COVID. And we always talk about COVID. We don't mention the year. We just say since COVID. But there was this, we all know, there felt like there was this seismic shift or this coming of age of a lot of different social pressures in 2020. And then there was this, parents got involved in their kids' education in a way that they hadn't before, largely because they were online. Even if they sent their kids to brick and mortar schools locally, for the first time, they were observers of those classrooms in an online setting. They were also in their kids' curriculum more. And so there were a lot of parents who thought, you know, I have different ideas about what I'd like for my children's education. And so you see this proliferation of schools starting and people wanting to get help starting up schools after 2020. And Capstone was no different, except it wasn't started by parents. It was started by just community members who thought that the growing end of South Fargo needed a school, in this case, a Christian school option. One of the board members was a graduate of Hillsdale College and really liked the classical liberal arts and could not receive that growing up in Fargo. So he felt like he wanted to give his hometown that brand of education. And that's why it became a classical school. The other board members didn't really know what classical ed was, but Luke did. And so he took them to Hillsdale and had them meet with people and learn about classical ed and visited some schools around the country in various states. And they were captivated. These are largely board members in their 60s and early 70s. They were captivated by what they saw in the classrooms there, student curiosity, rigor, manners, you know, just old school etiquette. And they were puzzled by it because they hadn't seen groups of young people behaving this way before, not in a long time at least. And so they wanted that culture in a school. And that's why they wanted to start a classical school, I think, and not just any private school or Christian school. Probably could have been a charter school, but North Dakota doesn't allow charters. And so they didn't have that option available to them. And so that opened up the door to say, well, do we want to be a Christian school specifically if we're going to be tuition based? And the answer was yes. So I ran into Fargo. Now, they started talking in fall of 2020 and then became a nonprofit 501c3 in 2021. We started classes in fall of 22. So we're in our second academic year and we're Hillsdale member school. So there's been some good support in terms of teacher training early on, curriculum support, so that you're a new school, but there's kind of some veteran status to your content and your practice and the training that your teachers receive right out of the gate, and there's no cost to the school. And so that's been a real bonus from Hillsdale to have that membership. We were the first private school to be a Hillsdale member school. They were in the Barney Charter School Initiative was how that started. And that was all charter schools that they were helping to start. But that's through basically free consultation. And so they provided that to our board to help them find a head of school, help them think through the business of doing school.
Good deal. And you guys now, you're in your second year and you're in the process of building a building, or you finished it? Because I know there's this big facility you guys are working on, right?
Yeah, we're in the process of building it. Fortunately, we got it closed up before winter. So it's heated inside of there. And it's fascinating. They heat a bubble outside of it, too, for doing mason work. So they're actually putting brick on the exterior in the brutal cold, even. I guess there comes a point where they can't heat it enough to do that. But they have been able to work through the winter. So we expect to open that in January of 25, probably start moving into it in the fall, but not have classes there till January of 25. So we'll be mid year three when the students move in. So we'll take an extended Christmas break in next school year to get the move accomplished.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. So jumping into questions. So there's obviously you're in your second year. There's of course challenges. You're building the building. So you're not in there yet. So there might be growth problems of like, man, we have too much need, but we don't have the building yet. Like, I would love to hear from your point of view, what are some of those biggest challenges you guys are kind of just currently up against, and how are you working on combating those right now? Hey, School Success Makers, just a really quick break from the episode to highlight our amazing sponsors over at America's Christian Credit Union. They are celebrating 65 years of service this year, and they provide essential school banking services and a tuition financing program for schools looking to reduce their risk and administrative burden. And you guys can find out all about them on their website, americaschristiancu.com/schools. That's americaschristiancu.com/schools. They are amazing over there, and I always like to to say, if you're a school that collects tuition and you have a hard time collecting all of tuition at the end of the year, maybe it comes around May, June, you're like, man, we only got collected 95 or 98% of what tuition was owed to our school. One of the things you can do is have your parents get a tuition financing loan through the credit union, and then they pay the credit union directly and you get your funds up front at the beginning of the year as the school. So you don't have to chase people throughout the year and you can focus on what you do best, and that is loving and educating your students. And it doesn't cost your school anything to do it. So check them out online, americaschristiancu.com/schools. All right, back to the show.
It was, there's a few of them. So one of them is finding good teachers for a model that will be new to most teachers. And so the classical education model that is not something that the typical teacher who's been through teacher training is going to be equipped for right away. It's, in some ways, it's simpler than what you learn in undergraduate about teaching. And in other ways, it's a little more challenging because of the content knowledge that's expected. And so there's the pedagogy is simpler, but you have to shed some things that are a part of a progressive educational model in order to fit within the classical model. So part of it is finding those teachers who desire that kind of change, who find the model appealing, and then recruiting them from elsewhere. You can't get all of them locally. And with the teacher shortages around the country, that's a fairly significant challenge. It's not been insurmountable for us, but it's significant. The other challenge is space and the pressures of growth against the pressure of building the right culture. And so there's a lot of demand right now for private education. It's not something that we're struggling with. Most even average private schools are finding themselves with space issues and record enrollments, at least record growth rates. Capstone's no different in terms of having that demand. But if we grow as fast as the demand, we think that we'll be less intentional about building our culture, and it might grow too fast for its own good. So tampering that down and tempering our excitement about getting bigger. I know we've limited ourselves on purpose. So we'll only ever have 40 students per grade level. The campus we're building, the entire campus design is meant for 540 kids, pre-K through 12th grade. So we're in three campuses in the fall. We're in two campuses right now. They're all in a half mile on the same street. We were fortunate to find, I guess it's Church Row, really. There's just a bunch of churches on this section that are all pretty friendly toward us. And so we're able to get very low cost campus accommodations for the first couple of years. But you're meeting in less than ideal spaces, you know, getting creative about, we held this spelling bee in basically a hallway yesterday, you know, so there's some things that are not glamorous, but that someday we'll tell stories about and look back on fondly. None of those challenges are really that difficult for us or insurmountable. The biggest challenge that's on the horizon is just, so for those who have started a new school before, any new venture, the pioneers at the beginning have a special kind of enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness about the ups and downs of starting something new, right? There's so many glorious benefits to being a part of a new vision and helping to build it with the team. There's also the fact that you pay the same or more tuition to come to our program as you would at a school that's been around 100 years. And some of the perks of that don't exist. So you have to believe so much in the distinctive model of the school or the culture of the school in order to make that sacrifice. And each year, the parent coming in is a little bit more consumer and a little bit less idealist, right? So the first year, it's like everybody's totally on board with the vision. We sold them on it in a corner of a building that was empty with one guy selling it and no proof it was even real, right? So those people bought the idea. Once it's established and doing well, as it is this year, people come for the product with the same expectations that consumers usually have and a different mentality. So if you're not delivering on your promise in any area and you're past the pioneer year, you're going to have more critical people. And they're not wrong for having those critiques. But the pioneering school has to accept that shift from everybody's excited to now they're customers who want the same thing that all the other schools have. They were just standing on the sidelines waiting a little less enthusiastically than the first bunch. And so they're more reserved. That's a challenge that you can kind of see under the surface, and you have to work, you know, just have to work with it intentionally to help them understand the value proposition of your school and that it's so different than the other schools around you, because people will leave for the new promised land and then and then kind of look back and say, well, what about what we used to have over here? And if you're not really delivering on your promise inspirationally, they might not be enamored with it as much once they lose what they left behind. So that's the challenge, I think, of a new school that's experienced the bliss of the honeymoon and then has to step into the reality of marriage. And so that's where we are, I think.
Does it also happen too for you guys? And I feel like schools can get into this place, and maybe you guys are or are not for this, but somebody comes in like, oh, it's a new school. Hey, I want this. And I want this. These parents are coming asking, and you're like, well, shoot, I guess we need to do that to get that family in. And you start making all these like changes. And then you're like, now we're not even going after what we were doing originally. And it's learning to say no to the things that they're good. Not saying they're bad things or good things. It's just not with our vision of a school that we're going for. Has that kind of come up where you guys have had to say no to parent requests at the risk of losing a family?
Yeah. And the truth is, Mitchell, you think when you open that you've communicated all of those things, right? Okay. So you've got a website, you've got a handbook, you've got information meetings. You think all the talking points are consistent, that you've not misled anybody about what you're delivering. But communication's tricky, and people often hear something that you legitimately communicated in your weakness, even if you don't recall ever saying it. There's something about the way that you softened the blows of your hard commitments that might have given them hope that there would be something that you hadn't promised. And I think we get that. You know, the area that you look for it the most, parents, they purchase education. There's price models, right? There's product models where you've got a unique vision. And we're more the product model. So we're not trying to compete from a price standpoint. We've got a unique product that doesn't exist anywhere else in our area. So we think that we can be committed to that. But we're going to have to take losses along the way from people who were looking for, I would call ours a fine dining selection. And they want the diner. And I love a good diner, because at the diner, I can take all three of my kids and my wife, and we can all get something that we want that evening. It offers everything. This is the school that has all the AP classes, has all the band and choir and the jazz band and the special dance ensemble. And they've got everything going on. They've got classes in computer programming and in drafting and in, you know, home economic, family and consumer sciences. They've got all of these things, and maybe none of them are excellent, but they've got everything. Just as I can get a steak and I can get pizza and I can get breakfast at a diner, only the breakfast will be good if it's the typical diner. And so we just say, like, you can have everything on the menu and it'll be adequate, but you'll be able to have everything like a buffet. But you could sit down and be served with intentionality, food that's nuanced, right? That's sourced from really interesting places that tastes like food should taste, and it's not as processed. And that's the way we view classical education. And up front, parents are like, "Wow, it's beautiful. I love that." And then, are you sure you're not going to have football, Mr. Fisher? You know, I mean, we know sports aren't like the most important thing, but we were shaped a lot by sports as young people. We think we became better adults because of sports. They taught us life lessons. And we'll say things like, yeah, we have tons of sports. Football won't be one of them. And so then there's this rub where it's like, well, I loved the vision, but I can get all the subjects that look like they're on your schedule over here at this public school that has pretty good teachers. I know some of them, and they have football. So we can have both there. And then you're at the value proposition again, where you think, well, have I really communicated the value of what it is we do here that can't be found at that public school? And that challenge is true no matter what your model is. It's captivating hearts and minds, because it has to be more than just the mind. There has to be a desire that you capture and that you're feeding for what it is that you offer. And if your model is a little bit out of step with culture, and I think ours is a little bit, then you have to help people to understand they should desire it. And then saying no to those things that they want is a matter of establishing your school's brand more pointedly. Yeah. If you don't, and I think this is true for us in our early years, if we don't establish it with clarity now and consistency now, we won't know who we are 10 years from now, and neither will they. And at that point, we're the diner again, where we've basically offered everything to everyone. None of it can be done well because the resources aren't leveraged toward excellence, they're leveraged toward volume. And a lot of schools like us, whether they're classical or some other model that's, I don't want to say boutique, but it's at least niche and it's growing, but they're going to struggle, because now you start to basically disenfranchise or you have disillusioned customers who bought what you said you were, right? And now you're just selling out for these other things. So for us, it's painful. In the early years, you have to say goodbye to families after a year or two because they thought that they would persuade you to add the thing that was lacking. And we've been saying no, but then you have to look at your board and say, you got to trust, you believed in this vision. You started it for this reason. Can we trust that it was a good one, good enough to preserve it? And that's where we are. Fortunately, so far, the board says, yes, let's believe in it a little longer. And at the end of the day, people will know that your school is what it is. Do you have the support to make it through the ups and downs of the folks who are disappointed in the early going until you've established that?
Well, you guys, you nailed the challenges question. So that was perfect. So it's a perfect segue into what's going really good, which it sounds like from when we talked, there are a whole bunch of things that are going good. So let's dive into those. And of course, I have a couple specific questions for you in there, but anything that comes to mind in that area that's going really, really good?
Well, I mean, you know, culture, I think that's the most important thing for us. And it's, we believe that if you give students the product that we've put together, that they end up in their spirit different than the typical child. They end up joyful about school. They end up curious about learning. They don't feel coerced into their behaviors at school or into doing well on a test. There's a shared positive peer pressure that doesn't feel like pressure. It's just the social effect of people striving for good and beautiful things together consistently. There's a sharpening that happens. The collegiality among the teachers is very strong. And so we call it our friends apartment. We have some collective office space for teachers because we're in tight spaces. And we'll miss it someday because they go to do their planning and in that shared space, and they end up all just socializing, you know. But I walk through there and they're talking, you know, they're all geeking out over things in the curriculum or ideas for teaching. And that what's being created in that space is super powerful. So it's just culture throughout, right? And then conflict resolution at the school's going really well. You have to have conflict to know that, but there's a lot of conflict for sure in any school. And what I'm finding is that when you start something new and you're able to say, nope, no unhealthy conflict resolution here, right? Which usually looks like avoidance or talking to all the wrong people around the issue. We do all of the painful redirecting and aren't stepping into the negative dynamics that often happen around conflict. So all of those things are going well. And so the culture is very strong. And most people would probably say, well, that school's doing well. They have a great capital campaign going on and they're succeeding. But I'm not, that means nothing if the culture's bad, right? We'll have this big edifice built. We'll have this nice endowment. And at the end of the day, it'll be this fake facade with an empty shell, you know, and that's not who we want to be. So the heart of the school is strong. And that's my greatest success story in the first 2 years, is that we have that. And I think that's easy because when somebody enrolls in our school, we're meeting in temporary spaces and we don't have a proven track record. So they're coming for the same thing for the most part. We've sold them on the culture. And so they're, you know, it's been easy to shape it because the parents are shaping that very thing in their homes. In a couple of years, when you're in the most beautiful campus in the region, and, you know, your sports are starting to have a little more success, your arts are becoming known, people will come for those things, and the culture might be off, and we might not discern that in the enrollment process. So we'll have bigger challenges there in the future, which is why this early success is so important.
Good foundation, for sure.
Yeah.
Now, we talked about like the funds that you guys have been able to get from just donors and different fundraising things you've done. I'd love to kind of let's hone in on that one. That's come up a few times for different guests and just different schools that we've talked to, and just in general of like, that is a hard one for a lot of schools, especially the smaller schools. I feel like they're the ones that maybe have the hardest time where they'll, and I know I was sharing with you, my son's school does all this work and prep and they do this gala and they're like making a few thousand dollars, but it's all off of the existing families. And so I know there's schools listening that would go, I'd love to find a way to fundraise without making people feel weird and uncomfortable, but also getting outside of the actual parents of the school to get money. And so I'd love to see, like, is there any strategies or things that you would share with the listeners about fundraising to help them in this coming season?
Yeah, I mean, well, so one of the things about fundraising is that you should ask the question, why is it necessary to begin with? And if a school doesn't ask that question, they're probably not starting far enough back in the progression. If you start with why do we have to fundraise, those answers matter. And in most cases, the fundraising is going on for two reasons. One is capital, right? We need to build something, or we need to have an endowment. And the reason people want an endowment is to fund operations eventually, right? That you have this alternative revenue that's consistent where the principal's growing, but I still got this income coming in to subsidize so I can charge less tuition. But at the end of the day, either my enrollment's too low or my tuition's too low, or both are happening. Sure. And most of the time, what happens is schools undercharge, trying to stay competitive with their market. And at the end of the day, everybody's paying the same amount they would have had we charged the tuition that we should have to begin with. And we would have had a lot of time back, a lot of labor back. And so we have an issue there in most schools. So we're fundraising because our business model is not really sustainable. But the other reason that we fundraise is generally because we want to enhance the program, add features, add building. That's capital. And those are big dollars. And getting to those kinds of dollars often means getting outside of your parent body. And for many schools, many private schools today, they're only maybe 30. The old schools are maybe 50, 60 years old. Now, if they had a great alumni program in the early going, maybe they're doing okay with that development. But most didn't, because they were working on shoestring budgets and everybody was busy with the immediate in the day to day and they weren't thinking long term. So if that's the case, and that's most schools, you need friends outside of your school. And ultimately, that's a network exercise. And so much of fundraising and enrollment is all sales. And the principles from the sales world and the business world translate into the school. And so if people want to say, well, I need to just go talk to these schools and find out how to do it. Truthfully, if you spend some time with some really successful salespeople and people in the business world, you might figure out some strategies that will work well for your school. And I think that's what happened with us, was that the relationships in the community and the networking, the very intentional full-time kind of networking that we've been doing to share the story and to get to know what is it that the community wants outside of our school? How is it that our proposition to these families and donors and companies in our area is one of entire community benefit and not just those for the kids who attend the school? Mm-hmm. Having been in Philadelphia, it's really tough to sell that because there's so many private schools and everybody felt like they were this elite, prestigious place where you go to shelter yourself from the common man. And we don't view ourselves that way. And our community views us as somebody that's going to add value to their workplace and to their neighborhood and to their church and so forth. And that's where the story is. It's can we help people understand that this school, investing in this school, is investing in the entire community? If you don't know the answer to that yourself, it's a little tough to go out and build those relationships in a compelling way. But I would start there, ask the right questions. We might not need to be fundraising if we can just get our business model straight. And then when we do fundraise, it'll always be for added value and not to pay the bill for this year, which is a trap that a lot of schools get into. And if they just ask themselves, how much do I have to increase tuition to erase the fundraising? It's not that much, right? At least the annual fund part that so many schools do.
Yeah. I mean, just my son's school, just this past in January, they sent out a letter in November and they said, hey, we've allowed everybody that wants to pay by a credit card, and we have eaten the fees. As a school, we've eaten the fees.
Sure.
And we're going to get rid of that in January. And they said like 97% of people paid by credit card. So I did the math real quick of how much are they going to be saving every month now just from January. And so it was $5,000 a month, like between if that's really how many people paid. So just like that, they didn't even have to raise anything. Now, granted, I'm paying, you know, whatever extra dollars for it. The school's now making another $5,000 a month.
That's right.
$60,000 or 10 months of education. Yeah. Talking 50 grand swing just with that. It's like, well, that was a good decision. Like, I see that. I don't mind doing that one. And I just feel like, yeah, there's those simple things like what was a school just not thinking of? And that was a quick one that they came up with.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's huge. And all of those simple business practice things are the low hanging fruit, right? You don't raise $3 million for your building addition that way, but it's definitely the way you can maybe get rid of the annual fund drudgery, which nobody loves, because at the end of the day, we're just saying, hey, we didn't charge enough. Can you guys help? And that's not inspiring. You know, like nobody really wants to do that. So that's getting your hard income, which is basically your tuition, maybe whatever you have coming from something like an endowment, getting that to be like 98% of your revenue, if not 100% of the revenue needed for operations, is the goal. And it can be done because the same, as you said, the same stakeholders are paying it regardless. And so you might as well get it done with tuition and have everybody be, you know, already budgeted in.
Yeah. The worst thing you want is, okay, we're going to on purpose do it at this much and then have to fundraise to make up the difference and try and get that from the families when I'd rather just, yeah, I'd rather have the same monthly payment for tuition. And then when you do a fundraiser, like you had hinted out, you got to be specific with it. And so I've seen schools, my son's school specifically, when they did this, they were like, we're doing a fundraiser. We're trying to raise $10,000. And I said, what are you raising $10,000 for? And they're like, well, we're probably going to use a little bit over here. And then we're probably going to do, a lot of it's going to go to the playground. And I said, well, you got to tell people you're raising money for the playground. You'll raise so much more money if you tell them where it's going, you know?
Playgrounds are huge.
And that's, and so she finally did that. And the next time she said, we're going to finish, use this to finish the head of school, use this to finish the playground. Yeah. And they raised the money to finish the playground. And I was like, well, that's a good reason. People want to give to something specific. I want to know where it's going, like what are you using it for? So any specifics on that? I mean, have you, you know, you guys are building this beautiful state-of-the-art facility, which anybody listening, you should go Google Capstone Classical in Fargo and go check out the facility that they're building. There's a couple pictures on their, I think it's just a Google listing in the website. But it's beautiful. Like, is there anything you guys have seen of like, hey guys, here's the vision of what we're doing, and they buy into it because you have cast that. You're not just saying, hey, we're doing a school. Can you give me $1 million? We're doing a school. Like, they're gonna be like, okay, like why? So any maybe thing on that?
Yes. Hey, school success makers, just a really quick break to highlight one of our amazing sponsors, and that is ClassReach. Now, ClassReach supports schools of all sizes from application to graduation. Take charge of your school with ease, power, and mobility using ClassReach, the school management software administrators and teachers love using. You can get your free demo at classreach.com. That's classreach.com. They are amazing people, and they provide this amazing SIS software for you to keep track of your students' grades, communicating with families that are enrolled, and a whole bunch more. So again, check it all out on their website, classreach.com. They are awesome. All right, now back to the show.
So up front, okay, so our model is classical, and beauty is one of the, so truth, goodness, and beauty are the, you know, it's the jargon of the trade. And so everybody talks about these transcendent things that are objectively true, good, and beautiful, and that the school is seeking to cultivate a love for those things within each student, not just recognizing it cognitively, but actually desiring what is truly good and beautiful. And that's what virtuous human beings do. Well, there used to be a belief, and I used to really disregard it because I was a modern or a postmodern. But there was a time where we understood that architecture speaks, and architecture should speak things that are true and good and beautiful. And the idea of classical architecture is that let's make sure this building has reason baked into it, the truth, right? Let's make sure there's things that echo the goodness that we all know is out there that's objective. And so there's things about certain kinds of symmetry and symbolism in the stonework, and what kind of flooring we put in a specific space, what kind of artwork do we want in the building? What lessons will we be teaching students when we walk by those things, whether it's a visceral connection the student makes with something beautiful or whether it's something that we can teach them eventually as they're passing it? We have busts of different figures from, you know, history around the building, particularly in the foyer of Founders Hall, that we sculpted to have put there so that students would see the people that they've heard from and read about in their curriculum, looking at them when they walk in the building, right? The tile floor where those things are in the foyer, which has our golden griffins, our mascot. We have this Italian marble griffin with the seven school virtues, which we call the griffin's weapons, in the floor when you walk in. But you transition from that tile into the library, which is the centerpiece of the front of the building. Putting the library in the center was important because this is a school, and we're teaching humility and gratitude for the wisdom of the ages. And so you want the great thinkers who are represented even in that library where their words are kept to greet you when you walk in. And then as you walk on that same floor down the steps into the library before it transitions to carpet, they are ushering you into the storehouse of wisdom. And so there's symbolism throughout the building. Will the kids know all of that unless we tell them? I don't know. Some of them will put it together. Others won't have any idea unless we point it out. And then they'll go, oh, there's more to this than meets the eye. Well, that's part of how you study science. You know, in a classical Christian school, you're studying how protein is made. And in the process, you start to figure out there's a factory within a cell at the molecular level with machines, and they're coded for in a binary code. And eventually you go, oh, there's a lot more than meets the eye to me sprinting 100 meters. There's stuff going on that makes that happen like hundreds of thousands of times over inside of cells in an unseen code that's governing the universe. Then they study physics and they see there's more to it than meets the eye. And so the idea is build a building that invites them into the richness that is all the content they study in school and the reason for it. When you walk in, Aquinas and Aristotle's stone reliefs are above the front doors outside so that they can see the marriage of faith and reason and understand that those two things work together. And so there's a lot that's been done there with the building throughout and the layout of the campus so that what we say is also spoken by the architecture. And when you explain to donors, we're building this thing, it's pretty unique. All of it is full of meaning and intentionality. They're inspired because they remember education as this kind of utilitarian thing you do to get a piece of paper that buys you admission to the next utilitarian thing you do to get you a check to pay for the American dream, which is also utilitarian, right, ultimately. And so people want more than that. And because we talk a lot about citizenship and we have some great thinkers in Western thought politically and otherwise also represented within the building, you have folks who buy into, well, we want better citizens in our country. And this school, like symbolically, even I look at the building and I can see they believe in the greatness of the Western heritage. And so those folks are thinking ideologically, I love this school, it resonates with what I value. And there has to be a value proposition outside of what you can get for your kids in the building, or your donors will only be those who pay tuition. So the owner of the sporting goods store is saying, I have this culture in my business. I want people like that coming to my business. And so those people in the community who are giving, who have no children or grandchildren at the school, believe that what they believe in will be promoted in the community because of what the children experience in the school. There's a value proposition for them. And you have to know, what's my value proposition for people who can't go to school here or send their family here? And even those who don't agree with my philosophy of education, what do we offer to the community, even if they're not in 100%? That's really the name of it, is what's the angle for these people? Why should they care?
Man. So as we look to wrap up, I usually ask for a piece of advice, but I'm going to ask for two from you. I mean, you can do more than two, but I'd love to have a piece of advice from you on the fundraising side. And then just a general like piece of advice of just anything that pops in your head for school related things. But if there was a fundraising piece of advice, those listening that are like, this is the bane of their existence, they hate it. Anything like advice wise for fundraising?
Yeah. Love and serve your donor. Want to know their heart, want to know their imagination, want to know what they believe about your community so that you can find the alignment. If you spend too much time talking about yourself and you don't get to know them, and I mean, get to know them not as a mercenary trying to get their money, get to know them to find out if they even should give money to you. And once you discover who they are, when you realize they have a kindred spirit with your vision for the school, you're no longer asking them for something, you're offering them something. And so get to know their heart. And that's priority number one. So when people say it's relational, it is. But that can't just be words. It has to be your disposition. They'll read the fake. I mean, they'll know it. Yeah. And so that would be the fundraising. And then, just generally speaking, this word's so overused, but authenticity. If you don't really believe in what you're doing, and if you can't really deliver on what you are promising, then don't go there. It's got to be authentic, and people want that. People will work for you. You'll recruit well if they sense that you're authentic, and you can't fake authenticity very long. Eventually, the fruit shows that it's not authentic, and so that's abstract. That's not very good advice. If I were going to make it more concrete, I guess I'd say do what it is that you really love. Build into a vision that you really love, and surround yourself by people who can actually make it happen. I think too often people are not concerned about anything other than career in their choice of of which school they're going to work in. It needs to be more about building something that's truly lovable for you. And then whatever you do is going to be gold. Just will.
Good deal. Well, I have a quote I'll share that when you were talking about the fundraising, it just popped in my head. I just heard it. I wrote it down this past week because I loved it. And you've probably heard a variation of something like this, but it says the number one reason people give is because they're asked. And the number one reason people don't give is because they're not asked.
It's true. Like,
man, like, duh. Like, it's one of those things, like, well, people wouldn't give to our school. It's like, did you ask them? Did you give them a good value proposition of what value you're bringing to their family, their city, the county, the state?
And, well, and look, everybody knows a salesperson who's wildly successful because he's buddies with the people he's selling to. You know, like, they feel like the salesman's not trying to make money off of them. They just know, I love having lunch with that guy, or, you know, we really click, you know, so I think that's true. Like, and it's easy to ask then, like, they start wanting to give to you because they just think you're great. The friendship, C.S. Lewis in The Four Loves talks about different kinds of friendships, but one of the friendships is that, and it's probably, to me, resonates the most, is it's two people standing shoulder to shoulder gazing at something that they both love and admire. And when you find someone who loves and admires what you love and admire, you're gonna both give to whatever that thing is. So yeah, asking's easy then.
Yeah, for sure. Love it. Well, hey, Paul, thank you for taking time out of your day to hop on the podcast.
My pleasure.
I love what you guys are doing. I can't wait to see the new building. I'll tell my wife, maybe we'll have to make a trip up to Fargo for business.
Yeah, I didn't sell Fargo very well, so I'll think of something else. You reach out, let me know. I'll give you a better sales pitch for her.
Well, I did joke with her when I was like, babe, maybe we should move to Fargo, when I first met you and you were talking about the school. Yep. And she's like, I'm not living in North Dakota. I was like, well, hold on. I'll sell you on it. I got to figure that out. So I just appreciate you. I can't wait to see when you guys launch next year and open up the campus and fill it with 500 or so students. But keep up the good work, man. I appreciate you very much.
All right. Thanks, Mitchell. You too.
Well, another huge shout out and a thank you to Paul for taking time and being on the podcast today. I love what he's doing up there in cold Fargo, North Dakota. I'm just wishing him and Capstone nothing but the best as they continue to grow and educate the next generation that's coming behind us. Super excited for them to launch their new facility in the beginning of 2025, I believe is when it was that he said. But if you get a chance, go check them out, Capstone Classical Academy in Fargo, North Dakota. Look at their website. It's a beautiful facility that they're building, and they've done a great job with fundraising and have donor support to be able to build that facility for all those students up there in North Dakota. But go check it out. It's pretty sweet stuff. But guys, we have three great free resources for you. And if you haven't checked out all three, I want to make sure you do so. The first one is, you're listening to it right now. It is our podcast, weekly episodes just for you, school leaders, that will help you, hopefully encourage you, teach you new things, give you some things that you can use to make your school better than it is right now. So continue to listen to the podcast, share it with other teachers and friends that you know that are in the education space. We would greatly appreciate that. And of course, if you're loving the podcast and our content, we would love a 5-star review from you wherever you listen to podcasts, because again, we provide this free for you guys, and that'd be some sweet kudos from you if you give us a 5-star review. The second free thing is, we have a free private community just for school leaders like you on Facebook called School Success Makers. I'm personally in that group. Would love to see you in there as well. Feel free to ask questions, connect with other teachers and leaders that are in the space inside of the group. But make sure you go join that, completely free. I want you to get tapped into that. And the third and final free one we have is on our website. Is a newsletter we send out every week called the School Success Report. The team has worked really, really hard on that. There's some great content. We highlight a teacher and an educator. We have some great articles that we've written, some resources we put in there. We're eventually going to be doing some giveaways and some really fun things with that. So make sure you sign up for the School Success Report. You can also sign up your friends and other colleagues for that as well. Just an email address on our website, schoolsuccessmakers.com. In the top right, click sign up for that School Success Report. Make sure you don't miss that. All right, guys, any questions, concerns, comments, or ideas, you can message us through our website and our contact form, and let us know if there's a specific guest you'd like to have on here that we can reach out for you on your behalf, or highlight one of your friends. Say, hey, this friend of mine would be great to be on the podcast. We'd love to chat with them and see if they would be a good fit. But I think that's all I got. So we will be back here next week with another amazing guest as usual on the School Success Podcast. We'll see you then.